Today's podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
All right, let's get back in here on Diamond Conversations. As always, on the Place to Be Nation podcasting network, on Place to Be Nation Pop. If you didn't know by now, my name is Ian, and every single week I bring somebody here from the world of professional baseball into my Diamond Conversations podcast, where this week we're sitting in the chair and talking to former New York Met, former tons of teams, Milwaukee Brewers. He's been all around, Arizona Diamondbacks, the one and only Nelson Figueroa, Emmy Award-winning Nelson Figueroa. How are you doing today, Nelson?
I'm doing well. Every day that we get closer to getting back to semi-normal life is another good day, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we're also joined on the show by the local statistician of Diamond Conversations, Mr. Doug Barclay, the ever-present man in the middle. But Nelson, we were just talking about before we got on here, you know, the next chapter in the soap opera that is this 2020 MLB season. You know, not to really get into too much because there's nothing else to talk about. But have you been following all the craziness that's been going on with this? And every day, a new story, a new chapter. And again, like a soap opera, you know, we don't know what's going to happen next.
Yeah, it's not the old days where things happen behind closed doors and, you know, there was a fear of things being leaked. It's like every other day you're finding out more and more information about inside things that are not ever supposed to be known on the outside. And this way, and then public opinion, of course, gets involved and tries to sway either side right now, because I mean, this is not an easy negotiation. You got to remember that the collective bargaining agreement is up next year. And so this has been kind of thrusted right in their face of pandemic and how are we going to come out of this and wanting to be, you know, pretty much the nation's pastime and come out and be the representative of sports and how things are getting back to normal. And I think we're seeing more and more as they're testing all around the different organizations, you know, they're finding that we are human too, and people are having COVID and it's popping up in every single camp. And just to think about the difficulties that adds to, you know, let alone negotiations of over money and over how many games and everything of that, the logistics of this whole thing are just go far beyond anything that it's not an easy like schoolyard. Okay, just pick sides, grab the bat and, you know, hey, let's play some ball.
Yeah.
It's definitely not that. So it's a logistical nightmare. And as we see with the health was number one, that was always the first concern, right? Every player said that, every owner said that, you know, health is the main concern. And now you're seeing, you know, guys are in spring training facilities only for a short time and boom, they're popping up with COVID. So could you imagine they start the season and all of a sudden the Chicago Cubs, oh, can't play this week. Why? Everybody's in quarantine.
One thing that I've been kind of curious about, you know, the public is learning a lot about how the MLBPA works right now.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as, you know, each team obviously has a representative, there is leadership up top. Mm-hmm. And my brother just messaged me. He had a power outage, and he'll be on back in just 1 second. But can you tell me a little bit about, you know, the process of having someone, you know, like electing the player representative and how these guys are communicating during this so that the player is really speaking for his team?
Well, that's the one thing. I mean, nowadays it's much easier, right? Communication is a group chat. And you have that group chat in there and they're able to voice your opinions and they're able to take votes very quickly. They're able to sit there and say, okay, the majority says, you know, we should play. The majority says if we get this X, Y, and Z in this deal, then they're willing to go ahead and get to the next level of this negotiations and try and, you know, get save the season, for lack of better phrase, I would say. This has been done for quite some time, and it's been a pretty smooth ship when it comes to representatives and for those, the executive board going to bat for the majority of the players. And most players are very comfortable with the guys that they have voted in place as their representatives. Each team has two representatives, and then, of course, there's the executive board, which those representatives answer to. And it's just like any other form of government. You hope that your representation best understands your needs, your wants, and is able to get those things done in a way that satisfy the majority. Not everybody's going to be satisfied. I mean, we see some of the highest paid players saying that, you know, they really don't want to play. And why would you risk it at all? And, you know, to each his own. That's something that this is, you're talking about coming out of a pandemic. You're talking about something that's never happened before. And for some guys, it's not even about the money. It's about the health. It's about risking your health And being in that kind of locker room environment with, you know, 35, 40 other guys who all it takes is one guy going out and, you know, hey, living the big league life, and he's hanging out at a bar, and next thing you know, he contracts it from somebody and brings it back to the rest of the team. You know, are you willing to risk that? And that's something that also has to be talked about in great lengths, about what are they going to do when they're, you know, staying in whatever city they're going to play in. Are they going to stay in a hotel and dorm type situation where they're kind of almost quarantined and just focused on baseball? It's going to be a totally different element. It's very difficult to try and corral grown men when they're playing a kid's game. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next step, if we get to that next step.
So if the, you know, what everyone's saying right now comes true in the next couple of days, that the commissioner does come down with some sort of mandated 58, 59, 60 game season, do you expect a significant number of players to just sit out?
I want to say, well, again, I think the majority are going to play, right? And what you're looking at is, if there's no minor league seasons, you're going to have 50 man rosters is the latest that I heard, with 30 active players. And then 20 who will be kind of a taxi squad at the nearest minor league station, where they would be playing either against other minor league, or not minor league teams, but other taxi squad teams that'll be ready to go at a moment's notice. But I think with 30 man rosters, there's not going to be a lot of room for that in a short schedule, a short season, I should say. But I think the majority are going to play. There are going to be some big names that may sit out. I mean, you saw, you know, Blake Snell is one of the very outspoken ones right from the beginning. It's not even a question about money. I think everybody realizes the economy and where we stand, and that everyone is standing to lose money. By being able to make millions of dollars to play baseball, yes, that's always been the dream. But at the same time, are those millions of dollars worth risking your health? And you may see some players and be surprised, some players that do sit out.
Now, you talked about the expanded rosters, you know, maybe up to 30 active and 50 guys in one spot. Throughout your career, you know, your role changed a lot from team to team, and as your career went on, how would you keep yourself warm? You know, how would you keep yourself ready to go? Obviously not in a situation like this, but
right,
when you were playing and your role could change, you know, any given week, how did you, you know, adapt to the different situations?
Well, that was one of the things that I could do well. I think once I got over the mental hurdle of being a starter all the time down in the minor leagues, and then I went up to the big leagues, and then I was, you know, starter, then middle reliever, then long reliever. And then it became a, you know, basically you're going to get in the game if we're losing and you're going to the ballpark every day going, so I got to hope that the starter gets knocked around so I can get in a game. That doesn't make any sense. But when you're kind of that guy that's on the bubble of being a fifth starter, sixth starter, long man, you look for every opportunity. So I think that as I got older, I prepared myself for any number of roles. You know, it started to realize that when the game started focusing on more on, you know, ground ball percentage, you know, that really mattered to me. I stopped trying to go for strikeouts. I stopped trying to power pitch to guys when I didn't have power stuff. I started pitching more to contact and trying to go in there and be as efficient as possible to go as long as I could and try and get as many ground balls. If I had a game, to me, a really good start would be if I went six innings, that's 18 outs. If I had 12 ground ball outs out of those 18, then I did my job. If I can sprinkle in five or six strikeouts and only a few fly balls, then that would make me really attractive for any role, because that's what it's about, is keeping the ball out of the air. I think when in this situation, with a taxi squad kind of atmosphere, you treat it almost like an extended spring training, or, you know, instructional league, or that real taxi squad when it comes to the playoffs, where guys are down in Florida and they're staying ready and they're staying, you know, trying to stay as ready as possible. You play a lot of scrimmages, inter squads, you know, you're seeing pitchers are seeing hitters, things of that nature. But again, these are unprecedented times, and people are going to have to make adjustments on the fly. And I can't see now being the time to complain about roles if you have an opportunity to play baseball.
Now, as we look back at your career, you know, you spent a lot of time at SNY, so you've talked a lot about being drafted by your hometown team and what it meant to come up with that system. Obviously, you came back for your second and then sort of third act with the Mets. But can you talk about, you know, being a young guy and that first trade out of the organization when you went to Arizona, how that felt to, you know, leave the organization, and what, you know, the next step was for you?
That was one of the most heartbreaking things that ever happened to me, because my goal from the beginning was, hey, I got drafted by the Mets. I wanted to be with the Mets. Career path kind of got put on turbo after that first full season. My first full season, I led the minor leagues in strikeouts, and I wasn't supposed to do that. I was a 30th round draft pick, got $2,500 to sign, and all of a sudden I'm out pitching their first rounders all around the league. And so that put me on the map. As I moved up the ranks, I had a stumbling block my first year in Double A, and moved to the bullpen for a little bit. Then after that, next year, when I'm pitching so well and our team is fighting to get into the playoffs, I got called into the office, and John Gibbons was the manager. And Gibby says to me, hey, I want to let you know that, you know, you've been pitching so well that you're going to head up to AAA. He goes, that's the good news. I go, what's the bad news? He goes, it's with another organization. And he said that, and it was like Charlie Brown, where everything kind of just went womp, 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 womp. I couldn't hear anything anymore. My ears were clogged up. I had a lump in my throat. My heart was pounding. And I was just trying not to cry, because I was like, and I told him, I said, why? Why me? Why, you know, why are you getting rid of me? And he's like, no, no, no. He's like, there's another team that really wants you. He explained to me how, you know, that first team that trades for you, the first team that signs you likes you. The team that trades for you wants you. The second team that trades for you needs you. That's how it usually works in baseball. And so as I decipher that, and I'm turning around trying to figure out what's next, I'm leaving my teammates. You know, we're making that playoff run. I'm heading over to Arizona. And I knew nothing about the West Coast. I knew nothing about Tucson and that dry heat. I landed in Fresno. I didn't have the right color of spikes. I had to borrow the Bat Boy spikes, which were about a size too small. I got out there to pitch, and it was 107 at game time. And that was at 7 o'clock at night in Fresno, California. And my debut did not go as planned. I gave up 4 solo home runs in the first 3 innings, but we were only losing, you know, 4-3 at the time. And I wound up, I think, pitching decently out of that. Then after that, really hit the ground running, pitched much better, and started to, again, put myself on that fast track to get to the big leagues, and in 2000 was able to do that. But it was heartbreaking, and you realize the business side of baseball and how much you're not in control over your own career. It doesn't matter what you do, it doesn't matter what you want. Once you sign that piece of paper for the first 5-6 years of your career, you become property of the New York Mets, and whatever they want to do with you, or whatever team, whatever they want to do with you, they do with you.
Thank you. Yeah, you mentioned that that second season in 96 in A-ball, 14-7, 2.04 ERA. And as I'm looking at your stats, I'm reminded, you know, you really are kind of the best example of a pitcher who saw the end of one era, I think, and the beginning of another. Because looking at it, you threw 8 complete games in A-ball, which I think is illegal now, right?
by law, yes.
So at what point in your career did you see that start to happen? Where, you know, just, you know, kind of using that stat, 8 complete games in A-ball is not going to happen, and you were there for some of it.
Yeah, no, it was very odd to me, because my whole persona, anyone who knew me. Anyone who's ever watched me, anyone who ever saw me, especially coming up through the minor league ranks, my goal was to go 9 innings every time. If I went less than that, I added those, you know, however many outs I missed, I added them to my laps of what I would do for running the next day. So if I had a bad game, then I was running, you know, tons of extra laps. I always wanted to try and go 9 innings. I just was wired that way. And that to me meant that you were a starter. You were someone who had the stamina, someone who had the arm strength. Maybe not arm speed, but arm strength to go the distance. And I always felt like I got stronger as the game went on. I learned a lot about hitters, you know, first 2 times facing them, and you wanted to face them at least 3 times. Towards the end of my career, and I can give you the when I saw it happen. And thank goodness it was really towards the end of my career, because in 2012, I was with the Yankees in AAA. And the minor league pitching coordinator was there with us. And he said to me, man, he goes, I've watched you through the years. I've seen you throw some amazing games. I remember this game, that game. You know, it was a game I threw 153 pitches. He said he saw that one. He says to me, that'll never happen here. And I go, what do you mean? And he goes, no, we don't do that here. So every game, was already kind of dictated that the starter would go five, maybe six. And then they had three relievers that were going to go every, they would alternate every other night. So guys that were on the 40-man roster had to pitch every other day. You know, it really wasn't about wins and losses for that AAA team. It wasn't about, so like guys like Dylan Betances were with me in AAA, and all they really cared about was his development of trying to harness the 98 mile an hour fastball and the breaking ball, because he just, he couldn't repeat his delivery. And it, he wound up going down to AA, took that step down and figured it out from there. And then all of a sudden, I know I was, you know, I was in Taiwan until 2014. And then I come back in 15 and I'm an analyst and I'm watching Dylan Betances tear up baseball. And I'm like, holy cow, what the hell did you do? You know, I said, what clicked finally? What clicked? And he said to me, because I used to play catch with this guy and he just couldn't repeat his delivery. He'd throw the ball one time and it would cut. He'd throw the ball the next time, it would sink. He'd throw the ball next time and it'd be into the stands. And he was like, man, this guy's a first rounder and he can't harness, you know, all this power that he has. Then it clicked for him, and really throwing the breaking ball. And what clicked for him was trying to not guide the breaking ball, but actually like throwing the breaking ball as hard as he could through the catcher's mask. And if it had the right spin and the right break and his release point, it was a straight down 88 mile an hour curveball, which isn't fair. That's not humanly fair. So that turned him into the animal that he is. But I remember the Yankees said to me, you'll never do that here. And this is why. And I looked at the coordinator and I was like, that's a shame. You know, that's just a real shame. And so what was crazy was they wound up releasing me. I was the oldest guy on the team. We got to the All-Star break and they wound up releasing me. I was second on the team in wins and second or third in ERA. And I wound up getting released. And the reason was I was the oldest guy on the team. I was like, okay. So I 2 days later, I signed with the Red Sox and I joined Pawtucket and helped them for their playoff push. We wind up playing the Yankees in the playoffs and I wind up eliminating them in the elimination game. And I pitched eight innings. I pitched eight innings against them. And I was so pissed that I didn't get to go nine because I wanted to really rub it in. To let them make sure they knew that, you know, especially when it comes to playoff time, if you're used to only going five innings, that's all you ever get out of somebody is five innings. And so we wound up doing that. And then I think the last game that I pitched was the championship game against the White Sox AAA team, and we won the whole thing. And I went complete game in that one. So that was, again, something that I grew up. Roy Halladay was a teammate of mine in Phillies, and there was no – you want to talk about last of a dying breed? That guy was the last of a dying breed.
Wow. So before I put it back to my brother, who seems like he has a power in his house now, which is good. You know, him and I are diehard Met fans, and you know, this is an opportunity. I'm not gonna pretend that I'm not, that I remember a very specific game of yours that I want to, you know, if you could take a few minutes to talk about. It was a game in Chicago, I think, in a very weird 2009 Met season when mm-hmm. you came up and you put seven innings and you had 10 strikeouts. Mm-hmm. At that point in your career, you know, can you just give us one example of what was working that day? What do you remember about that game?
Fear factor. I pitched my whole career with a fear factor. The fear factor of if I had a bad game, it could be my last big league game. And so I kind of had to always have that chip on my shoulder or that edge. And that game did not start out pretty. I gave up, I think it was one or two runs early on. I had guys in scoring position very early and I wound up getting out of the jam. And then all of a sudden something just clicked. I think, you know, it was that I got nothing to lose. I got to just leave it all out there. Let's see what happens. And, I had everything working that day. I had my split working. I had my cutter. I could use it on both sides of the plate to lefties and righties. I had my fastball. I was able to elevate to a lot of righties to keep them off of the lower strikes or the strikes just out of the strike zone. And they weren't able to catch up to the high fastball. And I was never a velocity guy. So if I was hitting 91, 92, it was all about, you know, sequencing it with coming right after a slow breaking ball or the location of it being up and in, and then this split finger or slider or cutter being down and away, just constantly moving the ball and being unpredictable. That's the one thing that as an analyst, and I sat watching the Mets for, you know, 4 years, 5 years, unpredictability always wins out. The more unpredictable you can be, the better, because in this day and age of analytics, they know the percentages of when you like to use what pitch and what count. And you're not making it fair to yourself if you become that predictable. There's a 70% chance that you're going to throw a slider when you're ahead of the count. They're sitting slider. And it doesn't matter how good your slider is. they're either going to foul it off and now, like a Syndergaard, run up his pitch count, and that's why he only gets to go 5 innings and 100 pitches, you know, if he's lucky to get through that, and you're always wanting more and more from him. So my biggest thing was unpredictability, moving the ball around, and facing Jake Fox 4 times that day because I punched him out all 4 times.
Yeah, I just saw that as a, you know, like I said, as a big Met fan, and just looking at these box scores now that I haven't seen in a while, some of these lineups, thank you for that bright spot of the 2009 season.
Yeah, no, that was it was a rough season, but for me, I got an opportunity to pitch, and I got to pitch without limits. Jerry Manuel was fantastic with me. Jerry Manuel literally, you know, put his hand on my shoulder after I had gotten bombed. I got bombed by the D-backs when I went back up. And when I got bombed by the D-backs, I literally was sitting in his office after the game, like ready with my stuff packed. And he goes, "What are you doing?" I go, "I'm out of here." He goes, "No, you're not." I go, "Really?" He goes, "No." He goes, "You had a bad game." I literally had 17 straight quality starts in AAA. Didn't give up more than 3 runs in any start. And I got bombed in the first inning and 2/3 against the D-backs. And so he looked me in the eye, patted me on the shoulder. He said, "You're not going anywhere." He's like, "You know, you'll get him next time." And I said, "Well, next time will be tomorrow. I'll be in the bullpen tomorrow if you need me." Sure enough, I think it wasn't the very next day, but the day after that was when Nice blew out his hamstring. And I wound up going 4 1/3 against the Cardinals. Yeah. And that was kind of the turning point for me in what could have been a very different career for me, with Jerry Manuel being the manager, because then that manager has confidence in you because he saw, you know what I mean? He saw me at my worst. He saw me get up off the mat, and he realized that if he had my back, then I could do some good things. And I had a bunch of losses that season, but I pitched well in every single game. And so he would always say it. It's not your fault. He would leave me in there. I think I had to average over 120 pitches a game, which nobody's doing these days. And I would constantly be out there for 120. And I remember Tim Redding was like, "Dude, what is it?" He goes, "He pulls me after like 75, 80 pitches. And I'm like, "You're on the last year of a contract. You're making $2.5 million. I don't even make half that. So of course they're going to want to see what I can do in this season where it's a lost season. They're going to throw me out there as long as they can and see if I can, you know, what kind of role I can fill next year at a much cheaper price than you would be." He made $2.5 million that year. He stood to make a pay raise, even if he had a bad season. So I said, that's the kind of the business side of baseball. And as I got older, I learned that I'm not in control of any of that, but you kind of learn how to play the game.
Are you surprised that Manuel never got another shot in the bigs, or did he just, you know, regenerate?
I am, and I think for him, managers in general, you talk about me being kind of that, you know, in between eras of how the game had changed. Managers are the same thing. Everybody talks about Wally Backman, you know, "Oh, Wally Backman's that gritty, gutsy, fiery manager you would like." And I said, he would have had a fist fight with either front office or with the superstar player, because he wasn't running as hard as he should have been. You know what I mean? So you can see him and Cespedes going toe-to-toe very quickly. And you can see him in the front office because he wants to make a lineup based on, you know, a couple of guys. He would love a McNeil-type player, you know? Yeah. McNeil's that scrappy type player that does everything he can to help the team win. And he would look at a guy like, you know, like Cano and be like, "This guy's sitting on the bench," and management's like, "No." And so Backman would have been kind of caught between those two worlds. That's one of the things for me is that I watch and see like what makes a good manager these days. And it's mainly guys that have the ability to do both, right? They have to be able to wear both hats. They have to be able to interact with the front office in a way where they can take in information, and they have to be able to get their players to buy into the information that they're given and be able to tell a player, "Hey, I know you went 4 for 4 yesterday with 2 bombs, but you got to sit today because we have a lefty-lefty matchup that isn't favorable to you." And somehow make that make sense, where I know when I was coming up, if a third baseman was playing and he wanted to be a starter, he played 100 and, you know, he would play 140 out of 141 games, or else he couldn't be a starter in the major leagues. You know what I mean? He couldn't be that everyday guy. Now what you're looking at is most players are being put on a 3/4 of a season type deal. They can play 120 at their max and have more days off and space out, more rest, and they feel like they get more out of that player and they're able to get. But you're still seeing the same thing kind of with the Mets with the injuries, and the injury bug goes around. So you can't predict that kind of stuff. But I understand it more from a production level.
How about the fact that it came full circle for you and you're able to get that redemption back in the Mets family, so to speak, you know, being drafted in 95 and then coming back towards the tail, you know, tail end, I guess, of like, not towards your career, but just more advanced in your veteran stage. Like, what was it like to get back into that mold, into that system of Mets baseball, you know, a team that you grew up with, you know, right. But now literally you're here and now you're playing a part. Like, what's that? What was that finally like for you?
Yeah. I mean, it was a dream come true right from the beginning, being able to put on Dwight Gooden's pants and Howard Johnson's jersey. And when I went down to spring training, I mean, that was it right there. I could have been never made it another day. And the organization had, what I heard at the time was a 2-year plan for me. They were going to give me 2 years to try and prove my worth. And if I struggled at all in 2 years, I was expendable. I mean, I only made $2,500 for a signing bonus. They figured I would be somebody that'd be good for coaching or front office because I was bilingual, went to Brandeis University. You know, they just felt like I was a good fit, even if it wasn't as a ball player on the field. And that's something you always look at because the window for a career is very short. Having the opportunity to put on the major league uniform 13 years after I got drafted, I mean, I kind of wrote a better script. The only thing that would have been different for me is that we would have made the playoffs and we would have won the World Series. And then, you know, that could have been the riding off into the sunset kind of moment. That never happened yet. To me, I'm not done with the organization by any means. I feel like I continue to do things with the organization, whether it's as an ambassador, doing suite visits with the fans at the stadium and talking baseball, going out to clinics with kids, and even doing the fantasy baseball with the older generation, having a chance to, you know, just spread the love of the game and doing it in the orange and blue means everything to me. I also know it's a business and that if an opportunity comes with another organization, I would love to try and be a pitching coach. And that's something that I had talked with Brody before and we've had discussions and I felt that I don't want to start out in rookie ball or A ball, or I feel like my 5 years of analyst work puts me in position to have a jump start over that and that I could help this major league team out right now. I know these guys inside and out. I know what it's like to pitch in New York. I know what it's like to fail in New York. And I know what it's like to have success in New York. I think one of the things that made me a good analyst was when Harvey struggled, I could relate to struggling. I could relate to not pitching with a 95 mile an hour fastball. I could relate to all those things. And I found a way to do it for a long time. I think for a guy like him, he wasn't used to that. He wasn't used to not having, you know, he didn't have the cheat code anymore. It wasn't a 100 mile an hour fastball and a 94 mile an hour slider. So he had to actually pitch. He had to actually work. He had to actually make less mistakes. And making less mistakes doesn't mean trying to get the same amount of swings and misses. Making less mistakes means being unpredictable and making sure that when they hit the ball, they're not timing the ball up to have perfect contact. And we saw the contact that was against him was getting harder and harder because he was just a two-pitch pitcher. Meanwhile, he had four pitches in the arsenal, and he did that in spring training. And I was hoping that he was going to bring that up north with him, and he never did. So that was a disappointing part of it for me. But as an analyst, as someone who loves the Mets and loves the game, I would have been able to break that down for him very quickly and try to put his mind frame in a different place, because there'll be days when you're 97, it'll feel like 105, but there's days where you're 97 is coming in like 90 and everybody's waiting for it. So that's my next, I think that's going to be my next goal. If everything gets back to normal, I'm going to try and get into coaching a little bit more and hopefully it'll be with the Mets. If not, then try and win a ring somewhere.
That's what I loved about what you brought to the broadcast was that you were fresh off a plane and you gave a modern perspective. And I love Bobby O. I love the 86 guys. And I could listen to the stories and all that stuff till the cows come home. But I thought you gave a fresh take of what we kind of can expect from the modern pitcher. And that whole Harvey thing was like the perfect start for you to really tell us and break it down for us, because had he gone to the minor leagues for the team, maybe his Mets career, his history, his trajectory might have changed. But there was such an internal struggle with, you know, the nightlife. Was he doing his own thing? And the whole nine yards that kind of took over, that had this guy just accepted the minor league assignment, do you think that would have changed maybe his trajectory with the team itself and maybe didn't change how his career, you know, has gone, and he's still trying to get back.
Yeah, 1,000,000%, because you're talking to someone who's gone down multiple times. And I always laugh because I'll get fans who will, you know, oh, I Googled your ERA. Oh, I Googled this. I will Google. And I say to them, the one thing that you don't know about me is that I made it to the major leagues not once, but 12 times. That's not an easy feat when you're someone who doesn't throw 97 miles an hour. So I was always the option. So biggest thing for me was when they made the phone call down to AAA, who's the best starter, who's your best reliever, who's the best guy that we could use today, I wanted my name to be all three of those things. And so I was a viable option no matter what. When it comes to Harvey, and to answer that question, with Harvey, it was almost like when Oliver Perez struggled, and Oliver Perez was almost begging to go to the minor leagues, and it happened to have the same agent. And you saw exactly what happened, because for some reason, the agent is looking at the value of the next contract. And in this day and age of baseball, there is no value in that next contract, because they're not giving guys who are successful multi-year deals nowadays. Every starting pitcher who came out was Alex Cobb, Lance Lynn, those guys, right? They came out and they got one-year deals. And you're like, uh-oh, what's going on? The owners are controlling free agent like never before. So I have to look at what's best for the pitcher. The pitcher himself. Now, if there's a pitching coach that I think in the minor league system, and it doesn't matter to me if it's in AAA, AA, A ball, rookie ball, but if there's a pitching coach that I think he works well with, or someone that can kind of tap into him in a different way than the major league guy is doing right now, because it just wasn't happening. Worthen was more than complimentary to him. Worthen kept telling him how he was, he's going to win a Cy Young this year. It's just a little mechanical thing and it's easy to fix. Worthen praised him nonstop. But I think he needed a different kind of pitching coach. I think he needed a realistic pitching coach. You know what I mean? Where someone that could tell him that, dude, do you know how many other guys there are who throw what you throw now? Like you were an elite when it came to your ability to throw 100 miles an hour and the nasty slider. Now you're back in the middle of the pack again. So what has to stand out is your ability to pitch and get outs, to use all those pitches. His changeup was his best pitch when he first came up to the big leagues. His changeup was his best pitch. It wasn't his hardest pitch. It wasn't his most often used pitch, but it was his best pitch, because hitters would say, I can't sit on all three of those pitches. I can't sit on the fastball and get a slider. I can't sit on a slider and get a fastball. But now I got to worry about a changeup that's just disappearing on me and coming in at a totally different speed, but makes it look like his fastball. To me, if he went down and he was able to just focus on pitching that way and just focus on – I don't care what the game result is, but just focus on batter by batter, executing his game plan, executing his pitch sequences, and doing that. It wouldn't have taken long either, but I think he would have been much better off than when he stayed up here and they used him in a mop-up role and he would go out there and strike out one guy, give up five runs, and then want to talk about the strikeout. That did me no good. It drove me crazy as an analyst.
That was such a crazy time, and it feels like so long ago too. That all that stuff went down. But as we get into the wrap up here now, and we kind of head towards the finish line, Doug usually likes to step in here, you know, being that my internet was knocked out for about 90% of this time because of a storm passing through, which, you know, I tip my cap. I apologize. Doug usually steps in now with some best and worst. So I'm going to hand it over to him, and he's going to try to test your own career knowledge here. Just a second.
Oh boy.
Thanks a lot, Nelson. So looking at your numbers, like I said before, you know, you kind of pop in and, you know, two pretty distinct eras. Now, very quickly, you know, some of the guys that you went hitless off you held Sammy Sosa is 0 for 12 against you. Adam Dunn, a very big power hitter of the period, 0 for 12. You seem to really handle Chipper Jones. So can you tell me the difference, you know, how does a guy get out someone at such a peak level? And then, you know, there's some guys you struggled against. You know, do you remember any of those guys specifically? Chipper Jones, for example, you know, how would you attack facing Chipper Jones?
Chipper Jones, for some reason, didn't pick up the ball well off me. And I constantly mixed it up on him. I don't think I ever threw him two fastballs in a row. And then there was an at-bat that I threw him three fastballs in a row, and it surprised the hell out of him. So with Chipper Jones, it was just – and with all those big guys, some of them have these crazy game plans where they will literally sit on one pitch and one pitch only, and they'll take a strikeout. They'll take three pitch. Jim Edmonds was a guy who owned me, right? And he's on that list of owning me. And with Jim Edmonds, I never forget it. The catcher I had was Paul Bacco. I was with the Brewers, and Bacco said to me, I had thrown him a changeup and he flied out to the warning track against me, but I got him out. Bacco says the next time, dude, don't shake me off. Just trust me. And I threw him a fastball right down the middle first pitch and he didn't budge. I'm like, okay. He put down fastball again. I threw the same thing. I got 0-2 count. He goes, shake my head. He goes, fastball again. I throw a fastball right down the middle. He takes strike three and just walks off. He goes, had you thrown a changeup, he was going to hit it 700 miles because that's all he was waiting on. So for those bigger hitters, like when they got the game report against me and they would get a scouting report that said, oh, okay, below average fastball, but it didn't say how much movement I had on pitches. It would say, you know, a guy has a fastball slider and a changeup. Well, it also didn't say I had a split finger. My curveball, I could throw it anywhere from 69 to 76. So I could shape my pitches and change angles with my pitches. I would even change arm angles. I'd slide step. So all these different things that I would do, and I would constantly try to keep these guys off balance because those are the type of hitters that you make a mistake over the hittable part of the plate and they don't miss it. It's usually a wall ball or worse. And so I had a really good success against a lot of those guys. Pujols was another guy like that where you almost had to make – I had made mistakes to Pujols on purpose, if that makes any sense. Because Pujols is such a machine at the bottom of the strike zone and he's looking for those pitches, he's not going to miss those pitches. But if I throw those same pitches elevated where all of a sudden for any other hitter, oh, my God, that's a perfect cookie mistake. Now he comes out of that being at the knees and ready to do almost like a launch angle swing, but attacking the ball at the knees, and I elevate it at the belly button. Now he has to change his approach and his swing, and I get him to pop up. I think Pujols was like 0 for 1 or 8 for 18 to start out my career against him. And coaches were like, how do you get him out? And I'm like, I hang pitches to him. I'm like, what? I'm like, I hang pitches. I throw my changeup and my slider as hard as I can up in the zone. So it has spin, and he's recognizing spin, and maybe he's thinking, okay, it's going to be down in the zone, and it stays up. And as long as he doesn't hit it out the yard, I win. I'm okay with that.
Pujols, 3 for 19 with a couple Ks. Did you watch any of that Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire doc the other day as a guy that handled Sosa quite well?
I did, and I just remember being, you know, watching baseball at that time and seeing what they were able to do for the game. The people in the streets, Washington Heights here in New York, people writing on their car windows, you know, the number with the bar of soap, how many home runs that Sammy had, and they would cross it out. He hit another one today, you know, beeping horns all through Washington Heights, Dominicans going crazy. And it was just an incredible time for baseball. And I guess the revival of baseball, really, where you saw these guys that were in the prime of their careers and, you know, were they enhanced? I think we all know most of them were enhanced. Pitchers were enhanced as well. So I can't take that away from the hitter because hitting is still the most difficult thing in sports to do. I've seen a lot of guys at the gym that are roided out and they can't hit a 2-2 slider to save their lives. So I still have to give some credit to the hitters.
They also led the league in neck pain from the balls that were flying out of
that ballpark. Oh yeah.
It was a fun time to relive. That was a great special. Hopefully they do more stuff like this going forward. But Nelson, man, look, I'm really sorry again. I think I deserve a redo at some point where I can go off my list of stuff I wanted to talk about. But I appreciate Doug stepping in. And even though he's a statistician, he did a hell of a job. And
he did. He held down the fort.
He did. I appreciate Doug. I appreciate you. And before we wrap it up, please share with the listeners of Diamond Conversations where they can find anything and everything going on in the world of Mr. Figgy, Nelson Figueroa.
Twitter and Instagram at Figgy NY, FIGGIENY. Right now, I'm currently the executive director of VoteInOrOut.com. It's a voter education app that will help you become more educated. Basically, as an analyst, I had to learn about what all these numbers mean and how you can pick your favorite players, right? Who always, oh, he's the best player ever. Well, actually, he's not if you look at the numbers. When it comes to, you know, our elections, I want to be able to have my mock draft ready that when I go to the polls, I know exactly what I'm voting for and who I'm voting for and what they're all about. So the website is a tremendous key to doing that. And also I work doing lessons with kids and working for an organization called the New York Youth Baseball Foundation and trying to, you know, create that next major leaguer and give them as much advice and help them fine tune their game as much as possible. So Figgy's been keeping busy even during the quarantine in the virtual world. So I think I'm excited about hopefully getting outdoors and being able to see some games. And if we'll do another one of these, at least another one of these, Ian. So don't you worry, you know how to find me.
I appreciate it, Nelson. Yeah. And if anybody wants to follow the show, it's at Diamond Combo on Twitter. If you want to follow me, it's at Chad EMB. And for Mr. Statistician Doug Barclay, it's at Doug Barclay 17. He usually loses out on the plugs too, so he really steps up and he worked his way up the chain for this episode.
I'll be killed if Jake Brown will kill me if I don't plug my podcast, right? So
yeah, our, please, you're a podcaster too.
Yes, our podcast has been on hiatus. So I took a job with the New York Post doing a New York Mets podcast called Amazing But True. We had 6 episodes and then the pandemic hit and we had to shut it down. But those first 6 episodes, we had some tremendous guests, including Mike Piazza, Steven Matz, Edgardo Alfonso, John Franco, Jim Brewer, Howie Rose, Doc Gooden. So we had some really big names just to start out a show. And we were having a great time with it, and hopefully we'll be back on that as soon as the season gets back underway.
Hey, and the thing that you have in common with Diamond Conversations is we both have Nelson Figueroa, so there you go. But thanks a lot, Nelson. We appreciate it. And if you haven't listened to this show, you don't know what you're missing, and we will catch you all on the flip side.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on 2 great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. And we want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop.